welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sally Becker.
I'm Mark Dunlap. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with a report on a rally at the state capitol to require new buildings to be all electric. Then, for a peace bucket, we hear about a June national rally for the Poor People's Campaign. Later on, we hear from a variety of people about a study on the impact of immigration enforcement on children. Then we have a segment on a local Ukrainian woman preparing for a demonstration in D.C. This weekend. And we end up with another library report from Bria Barthel. But first, here are the headlines.
The Capital Region has the second highest level of reported COVID-19 infections statewide, and hospitalizations are also continuing to trend upward. The region is seeing 55 per 100,000 tests positive daily for coronavirus on a seven-day average. New York and sections of New England are the nation's largest hotspots for coronavirus.
Congress is poised to approve nearly $40 billion in additional military and humanitarian aid for Ukraine, outstripping President Joe Biden's $33 billion request. Peace advocates note that such aid just prolongs the war and increases the number of people killed while providing a testing ground for the use of various weapons.
The city of Troy is investigating building a skate park in Hoosick Street and Fifth Avenue beneath the Collar City Bridge. A public meeting will be held in person at River Street Market and on Zoom at 6 p.m. Wednesday, May 18th.
The Assembly Codes Committee approved the New York Health single-payer bill on Tuesday, moving it closer to a full vote in the Assembly. The Assembly has passed the bill for several years, but it has never made it to the floor in the Senate, despite being sponsored by a majority of senators. The bill has been opposed by the insurance and drug industry, as well as some New York City public employees unions.
Advocates for sex workers gathered in Albany to urge lawmakers to pass a bill that would offer sex workers and trafficking survivors immunity from prosecution when they report crimes and seek medical care. Similar bills have passed in Oregon, California, New Hampshire, and Vermont.
The courts have officially moved the date for congressional and state Senate primaries to August 23rd. The primary for other races, including for governor and state assembly, presently remains as June 28th. That's it for the headlines.
For our first segment, Mark provides a report from Tuesday's rally at the Capitol in support of the Albany Electric Building.
With a little less than a month left in a New York State legislative session, lawmakers once again have failed to take any major action on climate change, despite the increasingly urgent warnings from the United Nations and the world scientists. One proposal that was initially in the governor's budget was to ban the use of gas in new buildings by 2027. Climate activists want a faster timeline of 2024, which is what New York City has recently adopted. The issue was removed from the budget due to the state assembly opposition, partially because they do not want policy issues to be decided in the budget, but also due from oppositions from unions in the construction field. Lawmakers and advocates from NYPERG, Food and Water Watch, New York Communities for Change, and others rallied at the Capitol to support the Old Electric Buildings Act on Tuesday. We hear from the main legislative sponsors, Senator Kavanaugh and Assemblymember Gallagher, and others, including Albany County Legislature Sam Fine. First, we hear from the MC, Liz Moran of Earth Justice.
Thank you all so much for joining us here today to call on New York State to pass the All Electric Buildings Act. The time is now. Now or never to get off of fossil fuels. So my name's Liz Moran. I'm the New York policy advocate with Earth Justice, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, recently released a dire report that found we have to start decreasing global greenhouse gas emissions and get off fossil fuels ASAP. It's common sense. We cannot keep building buildings to rely upon fossil fuels. The building sector in New York State makes up the largest sector of greenhouse gas emissions in New York. And the technology is here and available now. We have all electric buildings already coming online in New York State. So what's stopping us? The fossil fuel industry. The fossil fuel industry has spent billions over the course of decades lying about their role in causing the climate crisis. Are we going to let them continue to lie to us and deceive us now?
No!
That's right. We cannot let New York State be bamboozled by the fossil fuel industry any longer. We need this legislation now. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to the Senate bill sponsor, Senator Brian Kavanaugh.
You know, as I said, this is an incredibly important issue, and this is an incredibly important moment, and the time to get this done is now. We know that the Senate and the Assembly will adjourn for the year on June 2nd. Very soon. Somebody is counting the actual session. I think it's, how many is it? Nine. But, you know, we have basically about 4 weeks to get this done. We know that through the great work of the organizations present here and many others, New York City has already put a ban in place that is very similar to the one we're doing today. But we know that the rest of the state is also a huge producer of the pollution that is causing climate change, that is literally destroying the habitability of the planet we live on. By implementing the bill before us today, we would prevent the release of an additional 4 million metric tons of CO2 by 2040. That is in addition to the 2 million metric tons that the city bill already will get out of the system. And that is the equivalent of removing about 870,000 automobiles from our streets statewide for a year. We've been hearing recently some newfound interest in the part of many people who've been skeptical of all kinds of measures. Welcome, Emily Gallagher. We've been hearing from all kinds of people who have been in telling us we don't need to act urgency for so long, now saying, well, we can't act urgently to prevent new buildings that burn fossil fuel because we need to upgrade the grid, because we need to upgrade transmission, because we need new storage capacity and new technology to deliver electricity. By the way, all of those things are true. We do need to do all those things, but we need to act on this crisis on all fronts. We cannot wait to have a perfect electrical grid in order to stop building infrastructure that is going to require gas for decades to come. This is about stopping digging the hole deeper that we know we're already in. We have the opportunity to get this done. I'm very proud with so many colleagues in both houses of the legislature, and we've already had some good productive conversations this session with the governor's office, but it is time now to work together to get this done.
I'm now thrilled to introduce our Assembly Bill sponsor, Assemblymember Emily Gallagher.
I am thrilled to see everybody out here to support the All Electric Buildings Act. We have been gaining so much momentum for this bill, and it is critical because so many of us see that the environmental crisis that we are already in is not existential. It has become physically real. And we cannot wait any longer, and we cannot be detached from this issue. I know that here in the halls of Albany, we often become detached from the realities of what our bills do to everyday people and to our earth. And it is absolutely essential that we make sure that we keep reminding all of our colleagues and all of your representatives that this is a real thing that is happening and that we can prevent. Now, my colleague, Mr. Kavanaugh, he brought up so many good points. I really don't even have that much to add. But I do want to say that it is ridiculous that we are claiming not to have power over things that haven't even been built yet. We actually We have control over the businesses and over the real estate industry in this state. And for us to claim otherwise is ludicrous and honestly looks really like some of the people in charge are controlled by those industries instead of the other way around. It's really important that everyone band together and prove that we have the power. We ran for these seats to help our communities. And that is what we must do by passing the All Electric Buildings Act. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Assemblymember Matanis.
Point out the fact that if this industry is spending millions of dollars on commercials to lie to folk, then we know that we are on the right track. Every call and every email that I get of constituents upset about their cost of the electricity is an opportunity for me to teach and send them back out there with the right message. And we will continue to organize. We've got folks upstate and downstate supporting this. This is a no-brainer. We have goals with the CLCPA. Let's get this done.
Our next speaker is Sam Fine, Albany County Legislator.
I represent part of the city of Albany, the south end of Albany. And if you drove in today, you'll see lines of oil trains lined up right along 787 that goes all the way to the port of Albany. You'll see these full trains. When the price of oil goes up, the trains come. When it goes down, they disappear. But it goes right to the port of Albany. Right next to it is public housing. And that's the situation that we face. It's often the most vulnerable communities. It's low-income communities. Communities of color that have to face the worst impacts of fossil fuels. I think that just shows all the more urgency that we need to get off fossil fuels as soon as we can. My district is also filled with lots of old buildings, buildings that pollute a lot more, people that are paying higher electricity costs because those buildings are not sealed up and they have and they're burning lots of fossil fuels. So, you know, this is such a critical issue, and just want to thank everyone who's been pushing this.
Final speaker today is Bella, who is a NYPERG student from Hunter College.
Today, I just want to say, for young people like me, this is a generational climate issue. It's an issue that's front and center for us. We are seeing more severe storms and flash floods with water up to our waist just to get on the train, and people are drowning in their homes, in their basements, trapped. Our communities and our subways are unable to deal with it all. If we don't act now, Earth will still be here, but future generations may not be here to see it. And that's the reality. And all electric buildings is a solution that can be expanded easily and quickly. Buildings are already going up across the state that are gas-free and all electric. Unsurprisingly, the fossil fuel industry is not into electrifying everything because it hurts their profits. And now, even when gas is up to $6 or $7 a gallon, and while the world is burning, the fossil fuel industry is making record profit. They are doing it all at the expense of a livable future for me and my peers. Fossil fuel special interests will fight necessary action with misinformation, scare tactics, and by delaying climate solutions. But we are here today to implore that our legislative leaders do not fall for it. Pass the All Electric Building Act today.
This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Since we taped that piece, a new study by the New Buildings Institute and the National Resources Defense Council actually found that new all-electric single-family home construction costs in New York State are, particularly downstate, are $7,500 to $8,200 cheaper to construct than non-electric homes. And all electric new homes resulted in reduced total energy consumption by 34%. The Assembly will hold a hearing on the All Electric Buildings Act on Thursday.
For our peace segment, Pat Hines of the Trap Rock Peace and Justice Center in Western Massachusetts talks to Mark about why peace activists and others are joining in Poor People's Campaign March on Washington in June.
We're joined by Pat Hines, until recently still a board member of the Trap Rock Center for Peace and Justice, a former professor of environmental health at Boston University. And for a peace bucket, I saw that she recently wrote an op-ed, I guess, for a local paper about the Poor People's Campaign, a new incarnation. We certainly have had people on from the Capital District Poor People's Campaign, and there's going to be a big march, I believe, June 18th of this year for Mass Poor People's and Low Wage Workers Assembly and Moral March on Washington and to the polls. So, Pat, what inspired you to, I guess, join the Poor People's Campaign?
Well, there is a woman in Western Massachusetts, and I think there are people like her all over the country who are local or regional directors of the Poor People's Campaign. And so she reached out to me and also many others in Western Massachusetts to see in what ways we could get involved, partner with the Poor People's Campaign. She also had the Trap Rock Center for Peace and Justice in mind. And I told her that I thought the best thing that I could do for the Poor People's Campaign was to write a piece on it for our regional newspaper. I have a column in that, a monthly column. And so I would use my, was it April or May column for interviewing her and providing, informing and educating people here on the Poor People's Campaign, and specifically too on the March in Washington. And they are organizing buses. This will be from all over the country, you know, as well as here. So she wanted that information out as well for people who would like to go but need a ride, for example, want to go on a bus with a community of people. In interviewing her, I learned a little bit more in depth about the campaign. I think you, like I and so many others, were aware that this campaign, first of all, started a good 54 years ago with Martin Luther King, but that it's been revived over the past few years, and that this march was happening. But to learn the purpose of the march, to also learn more about this era's Poor People's Campaign, that was the point of my interview with her. And I'll simply say that the first Poor People's Campaign, the thing that was unique about it, and this was Martin Luther King, was that he joined materialism. Now, by that, I would say he meant capitalism, militarism. This was in the midst of the Vietnam War, and racism, calling these the three pillars of what will bring down our democracy in our country. I personally would like to add a fourth pillar to that, and that would be patriarchy, which is a structural rule based on dominance. And I think that too contributes to the poverty that we see and also the deep inequality that we see, given it is premised on inequality between men and women. But of course, Martin Luther King was tragically assassinated before the march. He could essentially be part of the march on Washington. And what I found interesting in looking more deeply into it was that the march went on in his spirit on Mother's Day. This was May 68, so Mother's Day 54 years ago. And it was led by Coretta Scott King with thousands of women. And that formed the first wave of demonstrators for the Poor People's Campaign.
Now,
so, yes, Mark.
One of the things I would note, I worked for many years for the Hunger Action Network in New York State, and we were probably the most visible statewide anti-poverty campaign. And we had a similar campaign before this campaign. But Hunger Action Network is one of the few anti-poverty groups that expressly went after the military budget and called for deep cuts every year, often, to be honest, often stronger than some of the peace groups did in terms of the size of the cuts. But yeah, we were sort of the outlier with that. There were not many anti-poverty groups that expressly went after the military budget. Has that changed with the Poor People's Campaign? Is there a more renewed emphasis on the military budget?
I would say yes. With this leadership, and also I think with members of it, very aware, keenly aware of the budget, the military budget, which of course is the highest in history in this country, and proposed for 800 and something like $15 billion for next year. And all you need to do is look at our discretionary budget and look at the percent of that budget dedicated to, let's say, food, to hunger, et cetera, nutrition, it would be just a couple of pennies for every dollar that is being given to, that is being allocated for militarism. I think currently that this Poor People's Campaign is very aware of that. They have said that there are 140 million poor and lower income people of all colors that they are currently representing. And they do address militarism and the war economy. They speak widely, broadly, strongly about that. But in addition, they have also included now in their campaign ecological devastation, the health impacts of pollution, and the denial of health care. So they have added dimensions of advocacy, which are crucial for poor people. I think what you identified, though, is it's been a weakness of many single issue movements. The peace movement simply focused on peace rather than on additionally poverty. For example, I think other anti-poverty campaigns not recognizing that militarism is at the base of sucking money away from all of the other needs in this country. However, that said, I've had many people from peace groups who would be focused on a conflict, on the arms budget, the military budget, et cetera, say that they don't understand why younger people focused on climate change, biodiversity, aren't also more active in the peace movement. And so we do have and have had historically, I think, what you pointed out, we have had our movements, which have so much in common, our social movements, be single issue movements. And I think the more that we can bring these issues together, that the issues of poor people, whether it's hunger, it's housing, et cetera, get crumbs from the master's table compared to the budget for the military, that we must keep making that message.
Well, we have about 2 minutes left. So I'm going to just to sort of follow up on that. So what peace groups, you know, are mobilizing, I guess, both to support this particular march on June 18th, but, you know, how can they also better integrate with the Poor People's Campaign in 90 seconds?
Yes. Okay. First, I think Code Pink is an excellent example. National group was having more and more profile. Excellent example of bringing these issues together. They will be in Washington on June 18th. And at the same time, protesting in wherever they can in front of General Dynamics, et cetera, the weapons industry.
How can people find out more information about this campaign? And is, you know, what can they do also besides going to the march to help support the goals of the campaign?
Yeah, well, I think the campaign wants to have regional offices and regional campaigns. So I would say for people to just, first of all, inquire in their own community. If there's an organized group, Poor People's Campaign, short of going to Washington. And let's see, your other question. Oh, well, I would say to basically use your internet to find out more about the national campaign, and then use your resources in your community, your connections, to find out if there is local organizing, as I discussed, that we're having in Western Massachusetts.
Well, thank you very much. You've been talking with Pat Hines, a former director, still board member of Trap Rock Center for Peace and Justice. June 18th, Poor People's Campaign, Washington, D.C. We'll have, I'm sure, the Capital District people on before then. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. So we do a peace segment usually every Wednesday. And as I noted, we'll definitely be having some of the organizers of the Capital District Poor People's Campaign on before June 18th.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Sally Becker.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany.
This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. For our next segment, a recent study has explored the dynamics of enforcement of immigration laws and how it shapes children's lives over time. Moses Nagel spoke to some of the researchers in part two of his report.
I'm Carter Leppin. I'm a student here at the University at Albany, and I currently work for Dr. Drebbe as a student research assistant. With her, I specifically work on qualitative data and quantitative data. So I've specifically been searching into demographics for the schools that our interviewees have attended, and I'm currently scanning each of the individual transcripts to better understand their experiences in relation to like their school, their household, and what immigration enforcement they've dealt with themselves.
That was Carter Leppin, an undergraduate at UAlbany who worked with Dr. Joanna Drebbe on a study of experiences with immigration enforcement during childhood. I reported May 10th on some of the findings of their interviews with U.S. citizen children of immigrants. An unusual thing about the study is the way that graduate students, undergrads, and professors all collaborated on different parts of the research. Professor Drebbe explained what led her to work this way.
I'm interviewing young people, they're age 18 to 30-something, and I'm 45. I have a couple children that age range. As I'm doing these interviews, you know, I can't like get out of my head. I'm a parent, and I'm in the parent mindset. And that feels really distancing, right? Because a young person can explain something, and I'm interpreting it through my eyes. And my experience, which is very different from what some of the young people are experiencing. So early on, we were able to develop a strategy for involving undergraduate students in the research. And the idea was originally we're going to just train them a little bit in some research methods. I'm doing all the interviews because of the trauma. We were sort of like, you know, chat on their idea, get some ideas. How can we find other young people like you, you know, involve UAlbany students in that process? And what happened was pretty eerie. In the first semester, we had four undergraduates, myself and a grad student. And this was pre-shutdown, so we were sitting together once a week. And the undergraduates who were in this project, I hadn't known it before, had these experiences themselves. And they started to share them in these funny ways. I think the grad research assistant and myself at the time, I think we had moments where we had chills because we were like, wow, we're talking about something that our students at UAlbany have lived, and I want their voices to be a part of this.
Eric Macias is a grad student in sociology. He led parts of the program and explained the way it came together.
I think what's really great about that collaboration with undergraduate students is not only that they learn about some of the process, but they allow us some insight because they're younger that maybe we don't have. So it's really trusting undergraduate students to provide helpful insights into what's happening, into what we're seeing in the data that maybe is not easy for us to get to because we're a little bit older. Second really interesting thing that we've seen that I don't think I've seen in any other project that I've been a part of is that the students really take charge in what they want to do each semester. So it kind of changes on the dynamics and based on the students' strengths and interests, and they kind of take ownership of different parts of the project. And from its initial idea, from the project's initial idea, it has kind of morphed into different things because of the students' interests. So from making a video, from doing more reflective writing of their own, from doing longer analytical memos to doing more, data analysis on quantitative available data that we have, all of that kind of just took on a life of its own because the student's interest. And I think that ownership just says so much about how unique this project is and allowing the students to feel empowered knowing that they are able to create knowledge just like many other scholars. And many of them happen to be first-generation college students or children of immigrants themselves. And it just provides a really kind of circular thing where a lot of them just kind of see themselves in the study itself, so they really take a lot of it.
Professor Drevi explained to me how it evolved to be not only research, but also support.
You know, the goal of social science research is to bring light on a topic that people may not see. And so we're doing that in a couple ways. We're trying to write about this, publish about it, say, look, this group of U.S. citizens suffering, they're living this and people aren't aware of it. We focus on undocumented folk, documented students, and those struggles are real and very important. But there's also this other group that is sort of suffering and we don't have public attention on it. So we're doing that by trying to write about it, but we're also kind of digesting it together as a group and thinking about our own lives. And most of the 19 young people who've been a part of this are members of migrant households in some way or another, and same with the graduate students.
Is that just because those are happen to be the ones who signed up, that they're drawn to it? Or
It's hard to say, because some people we kind of get come to us, but also UAlbany, I think 45, 47, maybe you should look it up, 50% of our students are students of color. A lot of them are from New York City. And in New York State, 1 in 4 people have a parent who's foreign born. And in New York City, it's something like, 36%, like more than 1 in 3 people. So once you have that population, this is something people are living. I think the people who are most traumatized by their experiences aren't coming to this, because I think people have got like a real trauma experience. A few people have like declined and decided not to do interviews. It's too hard. They haven't processed. So I think we're kind of getting the mid-range.
As Carter worked through the data, they began to see patterns and some surprising parallels with their own experiences.
I didn't realize a lot of the effects that my own father's like immigration status has had on me. I didn't process that it was like a problem, or that I was, becoming traumatized in a sense to all of this, or even that it was just generally like impacting why I wanted to go into the field that I want to. Like personally, I'm studying political science and Latin American, Caribbean, U.S. Latino studies. I want to go to law school. And through this project, and I got to see like some of these other individuals who went through very similar upbringings as I did, even from New York City in particular, and they're going into law school. They're going into immigration policy. They're doing advocacy. But not just for the good of people, but because they're traumatized by the process. And that's kind of like been the like biggest revelation, because yes, I want to learn about these topics and I want to do good, but why exactly do I want to? Simply because I've had to deal with this firsthand. And, it's a great thing in one sense, because we'll bring those emotions into it and we'll be able to help. But at the same time, what's I commonly have to go through with this project is like, when do I take a step back and work on myself before I try to learn how to deal with other people's emotions? Huh. Yeah. Me and Joanna have on many occasions had to like step back and like take a break. There's times where I have to put the transcript away and I'm like, this is too close to home. This is too similar to my own experience. And it's kind of like eerie and scary. It's like, just change the names and it'd be my story as well. And so that's kind of like the biggest thing. But it makes me want to do this more. It even has helped me consider doing my own form of research, because I want to do policy reform. I want to ensure that our like judiciary can actually have an impact on this. So as much as it can be mentally draining at times, I'm not only learning to better take care of my mental health in these kind of scenarios, but I'm also learning that at the same time, I'm making an impact with just every little piece of data that I collect. I'm helping Joanna make an impact, and I'm doing good with it.
Finally, Eric explained to me the feeling of equality that they achieved on the project.
Undergraduate students, graduate students, and the professors that are involved in the project see themselves in the same level. There's no hierarchy. Obviously, we know who the PI and who the co-PIs are in this study, but there's really this kind of horizontality that really allows for people in it to feel kind of open and welcome the conversation so it doesn't feel like you're being told what to do or that it is a stressful space to be in to do research. So I think that's a unique thing that I wanted to highlight.
Anyone who'd like a copy of the article based on this research recently published in the Journal of Marriage and Family, or who is interested in being interviewed for the ongoing research, can contact Dr. Drebby at jdreby@albany.edu. Reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, this is Moses Nagel.
In an earlier interview, Moses interviewed the lead author of this report, Joanna Drebby. This is part two. You can find all our segments on mediasanctuary.org. Go to the search engine button on the top right and just add in a topic.
Up next, Anna Alice, a local Ukrainian woman who has been working to oppose the invasion of Ukraine, talks with Sina Bazila Hickey about her upcoming May 14th demonstration in Washington, D.C.
Joining us again on Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Anna Allen, you are from the Capital Region, and you are the creator of the StopPutinsWar.org website. Welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me, Sina.
You have an update. Do you want to tell us about what you have happening on May 14th?
Yes. So with our book club, we are going to host an event in Washington, D.C. on the National Mall across from the White House. We're going to have an installation in support of Ukraine. We're going to place 1,400 black flags to represent 1,400 missiles that have been fired at Ukraine. This number came when I initially started this project, and that was about 45 days into the war. By now, the number of missiles that hit Ukraine is higher. It's about 2,100. And we are hoping to cause attention to the scale of the war and also hoping to elicit a response from our American government that will match the scale of the aggression and the scale of the war.
You mentioned book club, and the book club started as a Russian, Ukrainian, Slavic group of women from the Capital Region. It has grown to include more identities than that. And from the very beginning, your book club has been working on petitions and getting attention to help Ukrainians. How did the idea of the black flags come to be?
I think the point is for everybody to understand that this is not a small conflict. I think prior to this war, probably a lot of Americans did not quite realize where Ukraine is or how big it is. I mean, Ukraine is a country very similar in size to Texas, which is the largest state in the continental U.S., and it is very important, both industrial and agricultural country in the world with a population of 44 million people. And when Russia attacked Ukraine, it was a full-scale invasion, basically on the three sides of the country. And the flags were to represent missiles because it's something that may be a little bit easier to count. It would be maybe good to represent number of people who had died in this conflict, but unfortunately, that's very difficult to estimate because a lot of territory of Ukraine is still occupied by Russia, and the deaths on the territory, deaths in Mariupol, is nobody knows how many people died. A lot of people died from hunger and starvation. A lot of people died from just execution style. A lot of people have been relocated, forcefully relocated by Russians into Siberia and other remote parts of Russia. When they are relocated into remote parts of Russia, their Ukrainian documents get confiscated. We may never find those people. We may never find out what their fate is. So it's difficult to represent the number of people who has suffered in this conflict or the number of people who had perished in this conflict. We just thought that the number of missiles may be something that we can, you know, represent and be a little bit more accurate.
So just for the scale, you're showing the number through missiles from also an older number of missiles, which you're putting up 1,400 flags. But if you were to indicate the amount of human loss, it would be like 40 times amount of flags.
That is correct. And again, the numbers for the human loss are a lot more of an estimate.
Mm-hmm.
I think Pentagon has a fairly decent way of counting how many missiles are flying at Ukraine, because the numbers I'm giving you, so you know, comes from the American government as far as the missiles. But it's a lot harder to figure out individual people deaths.
So this is happening in Washington, D.C. on Saturday, May 14th. You and your book club are going down planting the flags. Do you have any plans for the Capital Region?
I try to host a basically identical event in Washington Park, and kind of was initially denied the date for the Tulip Festival, and then I requested a different date and kind of like haven't heard back since. But I probably will expand my efforts after this weekend.
So on the website, which is stop-putins-war.org, you have some information, which you did mention before we recorded, that you want to update it because it just keeps changing. You have some petitions to sign. There are actions that people can do on this website, find some information, support the flag effort. What else do you think is important to know about the event this weekend and the other efforts that you're working on?
I mean, I would say that in general, the local organizations been active trying to help Ukraine and Ukrainians in this conflict. The local chapter of Ukraine Congress Committee of America has collected thousands and thousands of dollars and had purchased bulletproof vests and helmets for the Ukrainian army. Also the 518 Ukrainians, they collected a lot of humanitarian aid, and initially they sort of were collecting more various things. At this point, they're collecting primarily medical supplies. There are individuals, I spoke to a lady yesterday who, you know, sews Ukrainian flags and sells them online. And the money that she gets, she sends to her friends in Ukraine who then, you know, continue humanitarian aid in the Ukraine. So there is a big outreach in this community. I do wish that the federal government provided a more broader and quicker reaction to the event. Yes, of course, our government is reacting, but like what I was telling you, as far as the scale of the war, Russia spends close to $900 million a day on the war in Ukraine, while United States so far contributed about $3.5 billion to try to help Ukraine in this war. And there's probably a similar amount of money from the countries that are members of a European Union. So the scale is very different between the amount of help that Ukraine is getting and how much money Russia is spending on this war. At the same time, Russia is receiving about $1 billion away, you know, from the sales of oil and gas. So sales of oil, gas all over the world help finance this war. Delaying help to Ukraine prolongs this war, and there is a fear that this will become a long-term frozen conflict, which is not good for either you know, Ukraine or the world. Not only during the prolonged war, people continue to die on both sides. Not only people continue to be displaced, but there is a huge effect on the world economy. As of now, Ukrainian ports have been blocked since the beginning of the war, and Ukraine cannot export grain and wheat. Many countries, mostly in Africa and Middle East, are very heavily dependent on the Ukrainian wheat. And same thing goes for a lot of other materials, such as steel, such as titanium. Ukraine cannot safely plant and harvest the wheat, sunflower, oats, and barley, and other agricultural products. A lot of fields have been bombed. The production for this year will definitely be down, and that will not be good as far as the feeding the population of the world. This is a conflict that's not over. And I hope that the listeners will join us in efforts to put the conflict in Ukraine to a quick end and not drag it on into a prolonged war. Thank you.
Thank you, Anna Allen, for joining us.
And that was a segment with Sina Vasilihiki. The demonstration will take place at the National Mall on Saturday, May 14th. For more info, you can check out stop-putins-war.org. Certainly, the sooner the war ends, the less number of people will be killed. We've done quite a few segments on the Ukraine situation. You can check out at mediasanctuary.org. Just go to the search button and type in the word Ukraine to hear the various voices we have interviewed so far.
And for our last segment, Lori Dreyer, branch manager of the public library in Lansingburg, talks with Bria Barthel about books.
Hi, this is Bria Barthel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And today, for talking about books, I'm with Lori Dreyer from the Lansingburg branch of the Troy Public Library. Lori, welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you so much for having me, Bria. I am so happy to be here. I am the branch manager at the Lansingburg branch of the Troy Public Library. I am so excited to talk about books and the library. We are up here in Lansingburg where there is so much going on. So let's get started with books. I want to tell you about a couple of my favorites, first of all. The first one is a great mystery series that I have been telling people about for a couple of years now. If you enjoy murder mysteries and or comedy, then I highly recommend the Thursday Murder Club series by Richard Osman. The first book in the series is called, appropriately enough, The Thursday Murder Club. And then the second book in the series is called The Man Who Died Twice. And you can find the physical books in the library. You can also find the books in ebook form or e-audiobook form. The books are wonderful and whimsical, and they take place in a... It's a senior living facility, but it's like a fancy senior living facility in the UK. And each of the detectives involved is an 80 plus character who is sort of on their own and has their own way of investigating. And it's very silly.
That sounds great. I don't usually connect comedy and humor with murder mysteries. So that sounds interesting. What else do you have to recommend today?
I just finished a book by Questlove called Music is History. It was recently the Everybody Read the Same Book pick for Overdrive and Libby, which is, of course, our app that the library uses for ebooks and e-audiobooks. It was a book that it's sort of autobiographical, but it's also a nonfiction book where he goes through and just chooses different years and different songs and kind of explores how they're related to history, general history, as well as his own history. And he does a great job, particularly with the audiobook, which is how I read it, where he is incorporating the actual song into the audiobook. My partner read the book, the actual book, and he said it was also very enjoyable. So I highly recommend that as well.
So for listeners like me who aren't as familiar, ebooks are where you're reading the text on your tablet or computer or phone, and e-audiobooks is where you're listening to it.
That is correct, Brea.
And what are the softwares for the ebooks versus the e-audiobooks again?
So you're going to want to download the Libby app. That's L-I-B-B-Y. And you can download that in the App Store, Google Play Store, wherever you get your apps for your devices.
Another book?
I recently read the library book by Susan Orlean. That was the book where she explores.
And for listeners, yes, the title of the book that the librarian is mentioning is indeed The Library Book.
Yes, yes, that is what she called the book. Now, of course, she wrote The Orchid Thief. The library book is the book where she's exploring the fire that took place in the 80s at the LA Public Library. And she goes through that and expands on the history of public libraries in general.
And this is my first time in the Lansingburg branch of Troy Public Library. Can you tell us a little bit about this amazing building?
Absolutely. I would be happy to. This building is almost 200 years old. It has an amazing history. It was built as the Lansingburg Academy. It's actually a building in two parts. The front part was built as a school, and then later the back part was added on, I believe, as a gymnasium. It has an illustrious history and has Herman Melville and Chester Arthur to add to its alumni. I believe it had a library in it from the late 1930s. And then it was solely a library in the 1990s on, although I don't think the library owned the building until after that. Now, of course, I'm sure I will get corrected.
Now, for book lovers who want to take books home rather than just borrow books from the library, I noticed there's something called the bookseller, S-E-L-L-E-R. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
So we have a really wonderful group of people that volunteer with the library, our Friends of the Library group, and they run a used book store called The Book Cellar. And they are open every Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And they sell all of a bunch of books here. They actually have a couple of locations. They also sell books down at, and then they're also at the farmers market regularly.
So they bring books, used books, for sale and sell them right at the farmer's market.
They do, yes. So they're very active, and you can find them throughout the community, always doing something. They're going to be at Troy Secret Garden Store coming up on June 9th.
And you said that there's some news about the library expanding its hours. Tell us about that.
Oh, yes. We are very excited to announce that we are going from 4 days a week and to 6 days a week. Starting in June, we are happy that we have been able to hire some more staff. And so we're going to be able to open back up to our pre-pandemic hours again. And that is a good, good thing.
Sounds great. Now, I know that when I do these sessions down at the main library, they have take it and make it kits or something. Do you do that? Do you have those available here also?
We do, yeah. The main library is wonderful, and they share their take and make kits with us. And so we have take and make kits for kids up here, so they can come and pick them up here if we're more convenient a location for them.
And I see you also have some connection with Capital Roots. Can you tell us about that?
We do. We've actually started several partnerships recently. So we have a partnership with Capital Roots where we have food delivered on Wednesday afternoons. And the food is available to people for free. They can come in on Wednesdays, anytime we're open, actually. And come in and get food for free. They're welcome to grab a whole bag of groceries or just one or two items. It includes some refrigerated items, but it's always fresh. We also have a partnership we've recently started with the City of Troy where we're doing composting workshops, the next one being on June 4th, which is a Saturday at 11 a.m. On July 14th, we're going to be doing a composting workshop for kids specifically. And then we have a Banned Books book club that we're starting up, and that's going to be on May 25th at 5:30 p.m. So come and join the fun.
So for the Banned Books book club, say that four times fast, is there a book that people should read in advance? Are you talking about books, or how does that work?
So for the first meeting, I'm actually not asking anybody to read a specific book. We're going to be talking about six different books for the first meeting, and you don't have to read them if you don't wish. We're going to be talking about The Great Gatsby, Catcher in the Rye, 1984, Persepolis, Fun Home, and one other book that is completely escaping my mind right now. So it's a mystery book. And you can just come and we will talk about all of these books. They've all been banned at one time or another. And we'll talk about why people ban books. And then at that meeting, we will determine what book we will read next.
And then there's a summer reading group, summer reading program. What's that?
So our summer reading program happens every year. And the thing that people never seem to realize is that we do summer reading programs for children as well as adults. So everybody can get in on the fun. We always have a summer reading challenge for adults. So bring the kids down and sign up for yourself as well. And the kids are going to have fun. The theme is the Oceans of Possibilities. So we're going to have all kinds of fun stuff for the kids to do. It's all going to be water, ocean based. I think we're going to have some fun crafts. I'm trying to think of fun ways for the kids to make jellyfish. Yeah. And I want to have a big truck day where we can have the kids climb all over some fire trucks and fun things like that.
Sign me up for that. Do I need to have a kid?
Right. I know. So, but don't forget to sign up yourself.
And then one little bit of history that you mentioned before we started recording is baseball, Major League Baseball is going to be doing something here in Lansingburg.
I know. Yeah. So it turns out that baseball has some well-grounded history here in Lansingburg. Major League Baseball is going to be putting a marker here in Lansingburg. It turns out that there's a baseball team, the Haymakers, that got their start here in Troy. And there is a local donor that would like to add to our collections a specifically baseball-themed collection, the Haymaker Collection, to our books. So they're waiting for Major League Baseball, MLB, to put the marker in. And then we will have a special collection called the Haymakers Collection, baseball-themed book collection. I can't wait.
Sounds great and sounds very summery. Yes. So this is, again, Bria Barthel talking with Lori Dreyer, the Lansingburg branch manager for Troy Public Library. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Bria.
So Bria goes to the library for book suggestions every month. We played the youth suggestions from the library earlier this week. And as always, you can check us out at the mediasanctuary.org. And we'll keep you up to date about the Major League Baseball connection.
And that concludes our show for today. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sally Becker.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Our engineer is the steadfast Sina Pasilahiki.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Hudson Mohawk Magazine is also available on demand as a podcast or on Facebook at Hudson Mohawk Magazine or as individual stories at mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.